I'm not. I don't know that I'm ready yet. In fact, I know I'm not ready. Watch this. The music's going to start, and I'm going to be like, ah!
A message from the king.
Everybody, I'm Kyle Ristall.
And I'm Molly Wood, and welcome to a musical edition of Make Me Smart. Okay, just kidding. Don't turn it off. Don't press stop. 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 It's okay.
What?
It's going to be a regular show. Everybody's hitting stop because I said it was a musical edition.
Yeah, right?
We are joined, as always, by you, because none of us is as smart as all of us. I promise there won't be that much singing.
There won't be unless we decide to, in which case there will be, because we're the ones with the microphone and you're not. Okay. So we're going to talk about changing minds today in kind of a roundabout way. It's a conversation about sexual harassment and teaching people about how not to do it and sort of very big picture concepts, really, about that. It's about training videos, believe it or not. But it's it's a much more zen conversation than that. So just trust me on that one.
Yeah, implicit bias, all of that through this kind of awesomely pedestrian lens that all of us can relate to. We will be talking to Morgan Mercer. She is trying to change the industry of training videos, those ones you have to watch at work that are terrible, through virtual reality. I know this sounds like buzzword bingo, but it's really fascinating. Her company is called Vantage Point. It uses VR to foster empathy and actually encourage behavioral and maybe even changes on the inside in the workplace.
Yes. First, however, we got to do some stuff. All right, I got two.
Yep, lay them on me.
It's Harley Davidson and Mid-Continent Nails.
Okay,
so here's the deal. Harley Davidson is in the news, right? So earlier this week, they announced they're going to send a bunch of manufacturing overseas because the president's tariffs and the retaliatory tariffs from the Europeans would make it too expensive to sell their bikes profitably in the European market. So they're taking that slice of their bike manufacturing and moving it overseas. The president is annoyed. Everybody else is saying, oh, my God, how did you not see this was going to happen? Right. So that's the choice they made. They're going to offshore part of their manufacturing to get away from tariffs. Mid-Continent Nails, on the other hand, the largest remaining nail manufacturing company in this economy, has gone exactly the opposite way. They are laying people off and cutting production. And I think it's really interesting that we have now the two poles of responses to the president's tariffs. You can take your manufacturing and move it overseas, which obviously costs American jobs and manufacturing base, or you can lay people off and cut production, which costs people's jobs and cuts manufacturing base. And I just think that's fascinating. It's a little bit Occam's razor-ish. That's probably not the right use of the word.
Yeah. In fact, I Googled this while you were talking because you didn't tell me what you're going to say. And indeed, it says that the nail factory is on the brink of extinction due specifically to the tariff situation. So my gut response to this is that unintended consequences don't have to be unforeseen. Like
exactly
this is something
right.
that I...
Exactly right.
Like this is something I've been on about the tech industry, which is like, hey, why don't you take some of these highly paid engineers and design thinking specialists? In fact, I know that right. we are pursuing someone on this concept of design thinking, and I really want to talk about this, which is there is no reason you can't game out the possible scenarios. And that is probably how, in a less one-man-driven government, policy decisions often do get made. Like, you game out the responses.
You didn't need to game this one out. People in the White House knew and know. Larry Kudlow, free trader extraordinaire, now the head of the President's National Economic Council, knew this was going to happen. Gary Cohn, who used to run the National Economic Council, knew this was going to happen, and that's why he left.
Right.
You're totally right.
It didn't even take.
It's unintended consequences that everybody except the guy making the decision knew, and now it's playing out in the economy.
And then what point are they just intended consequences? I mean, I guess I don't know.
Yeah.
I was in Montana over the weekend.
Yes.
Where, you know, where I grew up, right?
Yeah.
Red state. And so we were talking. So everybody was talking very carefully about politics-ish, mainly because my cousin is in the Navy and was in Guam is stationed in Guam. And so I was saying, like, hey, did you think you were going to get blown up? Like, what?
Yeah, sure.
You know, what was your what are your thoughts about all of the things that are happening? And then my other cousin, who was deployed in Iraq a bunch of times, is married to a woman who's a Nicaraguan immigrant. And she has, and I was saying, oh my, I know somebody who was going to move to Nicaragua and has now canceled that plan because there's so much unrest there. And he said, oh yeah, a couple of my wife's family members have come over to live with us because it's so bad there. And I was like, wait, what? Like, did they... this is actually a good news story. I said, did they have any trouble coming in? And he goes, no, they applied for asylum and got it.
Wow. There's a lot going on around that dining room table, huh?
Recently? Anyway, I mean, I was just like kind of happy. I was like, oh, great. Your family came over, asked for asylum, got it, and are now living safely with you. That's awesome news. Who knew? But the conversation was very much about the economy, which, you know, when people cast about for like the safe place to be. It's kind of that. And I said, well, and we were talking about, I said, hey, I know this guy who's fond of saying that the stock market is not the economy and the economy is not the stock market. And we ended up having the conversation that was like, yeah, business is doing great. None of us can afford a house.
Not anybody in
this room can afford their housing. You know, most of the people in the room have not gotten a raise. People are still just like scrabbling for any job they can get because 4% unemployment cuts both ways. And it was just, it was like nice to have a conversation where we were, where literally everybody was on the same page. And I was a little bit like, hey, politicians, take a note.
Yeah, yeah, totally. That's fascinating. Huh.
Take a note. Yep. So then my fixations are indeed on this kind of, on my favorite topic, which is moral capitalism.
Oh.
But here's what this just came out this past week on the 20th, I guess. The FTC, and I just think this is so interesting. The Federal Trade Commission is going to have a series of public hearings on what's happening with the economy, how business practices are, and new technologies are evolving, and how these developments, including, quote, international developments, might require, and now I'm quoting, adjustments to competition and consumer protection enforcement law, enforcement priorities, and policy.
Oh, wow.
And they're going to have multi-day hearings. Apparently, the last time they did something like this was in 1995, where they did this global competition and innovation hearings. And they would like to, like, self-examine and figure out if antitrust and consumer protection law are, I don't know, enough.
Huh.
And how that might affect communication, information, and media technology networks. Like, I am clearing my schedule for this.
Wow. Well, first of all, you need to get out more. But wow, that's interesting.
I know. No, this is what a nerdy policy wonk is. I am. But I want to go to this. So, and then they're taking public comment on all of this. And because so much of what we've been talking about is sort of the gradual disappearance of all consumer protection. Mm-hmm. I am just so curious to see which way the wind might be blowing at a set of hearings like this. And I think it's really interesting that they're having
I think that's fascinating. I wonder what kind of traction it's going to get. Totally fascinating.
Yeah.
You're right.
Me too.
Huh.
And then side note.
Yes.
There is, and this is just like a trend alert. Trend alert. We need like a sound effect for that. We have been talking on the tech show a lot about founder power.
Yes.
And with Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg. And there has been this teeny little bubble of shareholders in revolt over the imperial CEO situation. It's happening at Amazon. It's happening at Tesla. And it's happening at Facebook that shareholders are trying to separate the CEO from the chairman. Because in all three of those cases, the CEO is also the chairman of the board. And tear up the company's governance structure. At the last three board meetings of each of those companies, they forced a vote. And at the Amazon one, they got 26% of the vote was to split that, which, you know, obviously didn't win, but it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And Business Insider has a big story today about how shareholders who control $3 billion in Facebook are not going away. So,
yeah, but it's $3 billion of what market cap company, right? I mean, it's not, you know.
Like almost a trillion or whatever, but still.
Yeah, bazillion, bazoodle dollars.
But all it is the trend alert.
No,
all
that's
it is
fair.
It's a teeny little bubble.
Noted.
Trend alert.
On the record.
The end.
Bye.
All right. Tell us what you are fixated about, or I don't know, you know, draft us your public comment to the FTC about competition and innovation and email it to us. Wonk alert at makemesmart@marketplace.org. You can tweet us at Kai Rizdahl and at Molly Wood. And, you know, leave us a voicemail because we need all these ways. Oh, look at this. A segue to get more smart together. Here comes the announcement. Brrr, a message from the king.
All right. So we should say Molly's kid is in Hamilton. So that's why she's singing the message from the king. There is, in fact, an announcement. It is, however, a little bit of a secret for now. So shh.
But you guys get to be our alpha slash beta testers. Make Me Smart is inviting you, dear listeners, to try out, to be the first ones to try out this brand new thing from me and Kai. It is a surprise, like we said. But as Steve Jobs would say, we think you're going to love it.
Well, we're hoping you're going to like it. We think you are. The disclaimer goes like this. You need an Amazon Echo to participate. So if you have an Echo and you want to learn more about this secret thing we're doing, email us. testing@marketplace.org. One more time, testing@marketplace.org.
And write to us. Okay, this is for our most this is
prompt
for our most engaged listeners. Exactly. Those of you who get this sucker on Tuesday night, because if you want in on the fun with your Amazon Echo, you have to write to us by Wednesday. That is tomorrow, June 27th. So I hope you hopped on the show this week.
No pressure. Oh, man. I'll give it to you one more time. testing@marketplace.org. Send us an email that says you want in on the experiment. But now, however, time for some music. I don't know why I'm saying that all the time today. Time for some music. And then the CEO of Vantage Point, Morgan Mercer is her name. It's a totally fascinating conversation.
So we were going to try to make a list of workplace sexual harassment scandals, but one only has so much time in life. There have been so many: Mario Batali, Louis C.K., Matt Lauer, Charlie Rose. I mean, on and on and on, all in the workplace. Not to mention, of course, allegations of racial bias, Starbucks being the latest, biggest example. And a lot of times when this happens and these issues spark this public outcry and resignations and rounds of lawsuit firing and then that thing where everybody found out that Matt Lauer had a creepy button under his desk the door.
Remember that?
Yeah. Ugh. All of us innocent employees tend to get hit with a round of new training, like new sexual harassment training and racial. And in fact, Starbucks, you know, famously now closed down a bunch of stores to do racial bias training. But what we all know is that most of that training is awful, like the videos and then the online programs where you have to watch all of it before you can click through, and the bad acting. In fact, this is where apparently we have a clip. We have a clip of some bad acting.
You know, Wendy, you've really been doing a great job.
Thanks, Tom.
It's funny, since you've been here, I feel better about myself.
Oh, ew.
I've not had a lot to feel good about since my divorce.
God. I don't know what to say. I'm sorry about your divorce.
Well, you sure I can't interest you in some dinner?
Yeah, really, I have to get back. My boyfriend is expecting me.
Oh, I understand.
A few days after that, Tom blew up at her.
Wendy.
Yes, what's the matter?
Did you open the Greenberg account?
No, I had to...
What have you been doing? It's been 3 hours.
But
no,
I've
no,
only
no
been
buts.
Trying...
Just do what I tell you to do, all right?
So you know what's amazing. As cringeworthy as that was, it happens all the time in corporate America, I'm sure. I'm sure, right?
Clearly. Yeah. I mean, if the new, you know, well, for one of us, yeah, all of us ladies know that it does. And then also, the latest wave of lawsuits and reporting would suggest that, yes, it does. Yeah. So that said, you know, so far, as all the ladies and a lot of the men, frankly, also, I should acknowledge, would attest. And as the wave of lawsuits has shown us, the training is not working. It is something that we endure, we make fun of, we squeeze it in between the real work or put it off for years despite like the increasing numbers of emails. We joke about it at staff meetings. It has not so far proven to be any kind of path to real change.
So our guest today is going to do something about that. She has decided, honestly, as you will hear, that that is her life's work. Her name is Morgan Mercer. She's the founder and CEO of Vantage Point, which is a startup based right here in Los Angeles that produces training and videos using virtual reality. It immerses you with one of those headsets and the whole deal in not really very pleasant work scenarios that you have to navigate. And depending on how you respond, those scenarios are adaptive. They escalate or they de-escalate. Here's just a clip to give you a little sense.
Great. Great, great. This is going to be a great year.
Rachel, one really important note. Remember, it's a party, so pack something fitting.
I honestly don't know if I want to go anymore.
What do you mean? We've been working on this for months.
And what about all the after parties?
Well, honestly, look, that's part of it. James was texting me all night, asking me what I'm going to wear. I don't know.
Hey, it's Morgan, your mentor. I bet you noticed that things have gotten a little bit off the rails, and I want to help you understand why.
So, interestingly, what you're getting, when you hear it, you realize that the acting's probably about the same. The difference, of course, that, you know, it's important to know. But the difference is this virtual reality technology. Yeah. The idea that not only you're not just like sort of watching it, you're immersed in it. And what we're going to talk about with Morgan in this interview next is all the ways that makes you feel it more. So we asked her why this particular kind of training is more effective.
I mean, when you're dealing with any sort of subject that requires a level of empathy, a level of relating to another person, a level of understanding, humans just, you know, basically aren't necessarily inclined to be able to understand a different perspective or place themselves in somebody else's shoes without a little bit of coaching and a little bit of work. So, you know, being able to employ technology such as VR and actually, you know, step into the shoes of another person, actually understand how they're feeling, understand what they're going through in a completely new and immersive way holds a lot of power. And I think that's what's really going to move the needle forward on making training effective.
That empathy thing was fascinating, right? Because I don't think I've ever heard that in all the conversations we've had about training. But, and I know Molly's going to get to the whole does it work thing and can you get to empathy when people are, you know, yucky sometimes. But
I think you just got there.
Well, no. Because I'm going to let you ask that question, right? Because that's a big one for you and I get that. The one I want to get to is...
Yeah.
We're doing this for the lawyers, right? So how does side eye. All right, I'm not even going to get to finish that question. She was like,
I mean, historically we have done it, you know, for compliance and for the lawyers.
Right.
But I think that what you're seeing with the current landscape is that companies are starting to see this massive social movement, and now they're seeing the financial repercussions of the social movement. So you have articles coming out that are quantifying the amount of money that Fortune 500 companies are spending on loss of employee productivity, high employee turnover, and there are financial repercussions to the social movement, because ultimately you're dealing with human interactions. And when you're with a 30,000 person company, you know, you need to make sure that your employees are performing in a safe workspace and at the highest point of their productivity. Yeah. And so, you know, there's a financial cost associated with that. And so ultimately, if you're going to employ training, you should make sure that it works, and not just for compliance purposes, but also because it not only impacts the culture of your company, but it also impacts your bottom line.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we've been talking on this show so much about is sort of how, you know, talking past each other, how do you actually change hearts and minds? How do you create either empathy or understanding when we are tribal and divided, or we just think, you know, that the video we're watching at work that my boss made me watch is stupid and not worth my time. So this idea, like, I guess I wonder, when did you start to see it as a business opportunity to create training that would actually change people's minds or change their behavior?
You know, historically, I grew up in a pretty small town. I didn't really realize that I grew up in an echo chamber. And, you know, I'm a biracial female from the South, but I grew up in a very small town with kind of a limited scope of ideas that I was, you know, presented with and perspectives I was presented with. So it wasn't until I moved abroad internationally that I befriended somebody who came from a completely different cultural background. And I said something cushioned as a joke. It was so inappropriate and it hurt her. And it wasn't until I hurt somebody that I cared about that I looked inwardly and reflected. And, you know, I thought, why did I say this? Why do I think this? Why do I feel the way I feel? And why do I have this belief system? And then, you know, that's what caused me to formulate my own belief system. And in that moment, I realized that it takes really impacting somebody either close to you or you personally for people to overcome that barrier of understanding, to want to actually learn about a problem and understand the problem. And so, you know, that's the value in virtual reality. I literally woke up with the idea for the company over a year ago because I was thinking, you know, how else can you make somebody understand, you know, what it feels like or what it feels like to go through something, or, you know, to make them understand what it might feel like for a friend to go through something. And so I think, you know, really crossing that barrier of impact is what's going to cause people to care about the problem.
Where did you come from that you woke up this one morning thinking, I need to create a VR harassment and workplace training system?
Yeah. I've never had a feeling of such conviction in my life.
Wow.
You know, I woke up with the idea for this. I'm also a two-time survivor of sexual violence. And so my now advisor, Sarah Elizabeth Dill, she's the former director of criminal justice standards at the American Bar. And so she was giving a TED Talk on women as weapons of war. And afterwards, we were sitting around the private speaker dinner, and there were very respected thought leaders kind of sitting around a table, and the entire conversation centered around how nobody could identify intervention points, and nobody knew what to do once they could, because oftentimes they would identify them too late. And so 2 weeks later, I literally, actually at that event, I wrote on the whiteboard that my personal life's mission was to reduce societal apathy by reducing barriers of understanding via technology. And I had no idea what it meant at the time. It was just, you know, it was kind of like a lofty idea. And 2 weeks later, I literally woke up with the idea for this. And I texted, you know, my advisor, my now advisor, and a friend. And I literally was like, you know, this technology is so powerful. And how else will anybody truly understand? And I related it to my past experiences.
First of all, you've been doing this a year plus or minus, right?
Yeah.
How's business? Because timing is everything, and timing would seem to be exquisite for this line of work now.
Well, so that's what's interesting is I woke up with the idea in November 2016, and I messaged all of my friends and now some of my advisors, and they were like, great, what's your product? And, you know, we were still at a stage kind of in technology where standalone VR hadn't launched and where, you know, VR as a market was kind of cold and Me Too movement hadn't happened. And so I spent pretty much a year just trying to tell people what I wanted to do and convince them that, you know, it could be a business and that it could be something impactful, not just, you know, a business, but something impactful. And then, you know, I finally was like, either I'm going to do it or I'm not. And if I don't do it, I won't be happy with myself. So I quit my jobs and started working on it. And 2 weeks after I quit my jobs, the news about Harvey Weinstein broke. And so now what we're seeing is that because companies are starting to see, you know, both the social and financial repercussions, and then also, you know, governments are stepping in with stricter regulatory stances, like New York coming out with, you know, regulations essentially requiring all companies in New York after the 15 employee threshold to undergo annual training. I think that in terms of timing from the business perspective, I think that will be situated, you know, pretty decently.
Yeah.
So this feels like a good time for you to tell us actually what how your training works. Yeah. Like, what are the nuts and bolts? What do you know? What does an employee experience when they go through this kind of training in virtual reality?
Yeah, absolutely. So we do cover, you know, all of the topics, everything from identification to bystander intervention, compliance, response, and reporting. But it is 360 video. So what that means is that you're essentially placed in an office environment, and it's replicative of a real office environment. So, you know, we want to make it feel as close to your natural setting as possible.
So let me just for people who are trying to imagine this, I'm sitting there in my office doing my training and I've got a VR thing on my head.
Yeah. But you're immersed in the VR environment in a completely different office.
Yeah. Right. But that's the functionality, right?
Yep.
HR comes by and they distribute a bunch of headsets and and go.
And you
Got
step into the immersive environment.
Got it.
And so as the training unfolds, you're essentially interacting with the environment around you. So, you know, basically all of the choices you make either escalate or de-escalate the scenario. So what that means is that if you escalate the scenario at a different point than me, you're going to be shown a completely different outcome.
And if I keep getting it wrong, do you keep coming back and saying, no, here's another chance, right? It's adaptive testing?
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. And so, and then we tell you, here's what you did wrong. We're going to take you back through.
Right.
And so every single user is going to see, you know, essentially a different storyline, a different outcome. But I think that's more replicative of real life, right?
Sure,
because
totally.
Depending on your ability to actually pick up on the nuances of situations, depending on your ability to actually know how to appropriately respond, situations unfold completely differently. So,
Have you tested it? I'm curious to hear how people experience these interactions, and you know whether. How to what extent do they role play? Do you have someone play the harasser and see what that feels like? You know, how powerful can this get here?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's interesting. I oftentimes receive questions about, oh, well, why don't you have somebody, you know, simulate somebody being harassed and have them respond? What people don't understand is that this technology is so powerful that that is actually potentially very triggering.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, there's a right way to use it and there's a wrong way to use it. But just kind of the general response we've seen, it's been on the entire spectrum. Typically, the unanimous general response is, wow, this is so powerful. And I get it, because it's one thing to explain what it feels like. It's another to actually put the headset on and feel it. It's like talking about skydiving versus skydiving, right? There are two completely different feelings. But then the second thing is, it's interesting to see how different people respond based on their previous experiences and based on where they come from, based on, you know, kind of what they associate themselves with. It's interesting to see what different people pick up on and what they don't pick up on.
This is going to sound, Molly will appreciate me saying this and she will take it in the spirit with which it's intended. You won't know where I'm coming from, but I'm going to roll the dice and say it anyway.
Yeah.
And then we can talk about it. So we actually here at Marketplace have just gone through a whole wave of training, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was horrible. It was terrible. It was, oh my God, are we done? Can I minimize this on the screen and do my other work and whatever? This sounds, number one, like you're going to have to pay more attention. And two, it will be more, and here comes the part that's going to sound pejorative, but honestly, I don't mean it to. It's more touchy-feely, you know what I mean? You have to be more in touch with what you're thinking and feeling as opposed to clicking on,
but that's the goal.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the goal. Like, how else are you going to learn, you know? And exactly, you have no way to disengage, you know? You can't pick up your cell phone and text someone. You're literally immersed in an environment, so.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting because the more I talk to people in the space, the more I hear stories about, oh, somebody at my company actually created a bot to click through, questions. And it's one of those things where it's like historically other companies in the space know, you know, it's a known fact. It's built into the product. It's a known fact that employees don't engage with training programs. That's why you have to wait 2 minutes to answer a question. It's quite literally built into the product.
That's what I didn't know.
So, I mean, how can you change that?
Right.
And how do you make people care?
I want to ask you about the metrics, kind of. Mm-hmm. I mean, how, you know, it seems like in addition to the hilarious suckitude of your basic average corporate,
your competition,
you know, training video of your competition.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a focus on outcome.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a little certificate that you print out, and then that is the end of the training. Mm-hmm. Are you able to measure the impact of your product?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's kind of multifaceted. So one way that we do it is we measure levels of self-efficacy. So what self-efficacy is your confidence in your ability to actually identify a situation and then your confidence in your ability to know how to act. So, you know, everything from baseline testing, so gathering kind of the qualitative feedback of, now that you've undergone this experience and seen it from a new perspective, do you feel like you had an opportunity to step in? But also, you know, we have the ability to not just see, okay, did people click yes or no on this answer choice and get it right? We have the ability to actually look at, you know, if people are staring at these two answer choices for 10 seconds each and then ultimately choose the wrong one, 90% of your employees do that, you know, then people aren't understanding this concept. And so that comes back to either the way that we're teaching the concept or, you know, the information itself. And so that's a really useful insight both for us and then also, you know, for companies and also for users to understand.
How much does it cost companies? I just have to ask that one really marketplace-y question, which is, you know, a lot of people are going to need to do this for it to have a big, broad impact.
Yeah.
Is it going to be affordable?
Yeah, so we're trying to price it pretty similarly to existing solutions on the market, you know, because we do want companies to be able to afford this. We want this to be the new standard, essentially.
Kai, make me smart question. I know you have it written down there.
So here's something we ask everybody who comes in,
and
I'm curious actually to see what your answer is. The question is, what is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about?
That's a really good question. In this, you know, I'm starting a company initially focused on anti-sexual harassment training. And given kind of the current landscape, you would think like, oh, she's going to have the most support from women. But actually, some of my strongest allies have been men who are like, we want to support this. and have really, really, really gone to bat for me repetitively over and over. And I think that's been very surprising, because you go into things and you think, oh, it's going to be hard because, you know, because I'm a female and funding doesn't go to women. It's going to be hard because, you know, I'm X, Y, and Z. And then you see that you have a lot of men actually stepping up to support you. So that's been a positive surprise.
Told you it was going to be thoughtful, huh? Pretty zen conversation, right? About all that stuff, yeah.
It is. And we should say here, too, that the idea of virtual reality helping create empathy is not, it's not super new. And there's a lot of interesting work. So I visited this guy, Jeremy Bilinson, at Stanford, and he has what's called the Virtual Human Interaction Lab. And he's specifically working at a project called Empathy at Scale. And I tried it, and it is remarkable how quickly you can be immersed in feeling like another person. Like, basically, you put these headset, you know, these goggles on, you look at yourself in the mirror, yourself, except that you're a Black woman or a big white guy in my case, or, you know, or bull or whatever. And you, all you do is a series of exercises, like you touch your nose and you touch your head, but you see the person in the mirror who's not you. And within about, you know, they figured it out, it's like a minute and a half or 2 minutes, you are immersed enough that you can start experiencing things, how that person, and then they put you in a variety of scenarios. It's fascinating.
Could I just say, by way of giving a nod to the present environment in this country, that empathy at scale would not be a terrible thing right about now in America? That's all I'm saying.
It would not be a terrible thing. Exactly. Yeah. See?
Yeah.
And that's why we did this interview.
Snap, baby.
Boom. If you have questions or comments about, see how we like sneaked
we're
up
so
on you,
proud
you guys?
Of ourselves. We are so proud
we
of ourselves.
Just are. We're so delighted. Questions, questions or comments about training videos or empathy at scale or anything else, please email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org.
More straight ahead. First, got to pay the bills.
We're all about making people smarter, as you know, about the financial forces that govern our lives through solid reporting, interesting stories, and the kinds of conversations we get to have on programs like this one.
It's important work that we are already doing, have been doing for a long time, and with your help, we will do even more of it for as little as $5 a month, $5. Become a Marketplace investor.
This is a great opportunity to be part of our efforts to raise the economic intelligence of people across the country and to make a real impact on people's lives and the decisions that they make.
So now's the time, gang. Go to marketplace.org and donate whatever amount is right for you to become a Marketplace investor. And thanks a lot.
And now, dear friends, it is time to hear from you.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
Hi, Al Groves from Lawrenceville, Georgia.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Always answer the question you want to answer, not the question that was asked. I'm just saying.
I mean, so great. Like, and every time I'm like, I'm going to write that down. We've been talking a lot on the show about civility. Obviously, it's been one of the themes of this current set of shows that we're doing that we don't call a season, the idea of building compromise and how to talk to each other and how to, you know, use virtual reality to build empathy, all of that. And over the last 2 weeks, Kai and I specifically have been talking about discourse. And it's I only bring it up because I want to hear from you guys, like, and because we probably both of us so many thoughts that would maybe get us fired. But
I was just going to say, easy there, sister.
That we're not going to, well, you know what? Yeah. That I want to take the time to think through properly. And if you have ideas for how we can do this as a future episode, you know, one thing I noticed is that I encourage everyone to go back and listen to our conversation with George Lakoff about framing and framing the conversation and how to kind of take in information and not have it affect you or not restate the framing and give it more power. And in fact, CNN, like, I think Brian Stelter just had him on.
I know. I was just going to say, hello, we were there for a year ago. Brian, dude, man.
But definitely listen to it, because there's also there's a huge, you know, role for the press to play or not play here, which is like, just do the work.
Yeah.
But please, so send us your thoughts on this, on civility and discourse and what's the right way to act, because nobody really knows, but it's a really interesting conversation.
Yeah.
And now, to your existing comments. Gilbert Kennan wrote us this message about ethics, which relates back to Morgan's point about ethical issues that affect a company's bottom line.
If we conceptualize ethical failures as an external cost for firms, lawsuits
internalize those costs. This is, of course, dependent upon having laws and legal processes which are effective at targeting areas of ethical concern, and the whole thing is vulnerable to regulatory capture, but it has the advantage that you can target unethical behavior which consumers have difficulty recognizing or acting upon.
Yes, that is all true. That is all true.
Regulatory capture.
Yes. Yes. We asked some of you for insights on training. Listener Mitchell Robinson posted on Facebook that his harassment training, and here's the quote, had the obligatory vibe of a substitute teacher popping in a movie only to watch the first 45 minutes and never finishing it. Given what some of my gay and female co-workers told me, there were definitely some supervisors and managers who could have used some more routine follow-up training, which is totally true, right? I mean, we've all been there.
Mm-hmm.
Totally.
And
true.
Once a year kind of doesn't feel like enough. Yeah.
Does that mean we're due
so
again,
many.
By the way? I mean, we just had it like a year ago. Anyway.
Probably.
Stacey Jean, she wrote to say this, the effectiveness of these training videos, quote, 100%, 110% boils down to the management culture of the workplace. If the managers don't believe in the philosophy, all the video does is drive home that you have terrible managers. Yes, which we do not have here at Marketplace. We do not have terrible managers. If those of you who are listening
definitely
this far
not.
Into the cast who work here, it's not, we're not you, okay?
But it is true. I mean, culture comes from the top.
Yeah.
And then once it's embedded, it's so hard to change. And that's why – that is one of the big reasons that training alone – God, we should really get Dara Khosrowshahi on this show, the Uber, new
well,
Uber CEO.
Well, let's just call him up and see if he's busy.
Yeah. You know. I don't think he's like doing that. You know, he's had that big success in London. Maybe he's feeling flush.
That's right.
We are going to leave you here on a lighter note. Our listener, Garrett Hunter from Indianapolis, left us a voicemail that he was listening to some old CDs and he came across, this is like so perfect for today's musical vibe, an economics song.
Oh my God, really?
And here you go.
Okay.
And I realized that this probably would have been better suited for the series last year with moral economics, but moral economics tends to be revolving and coming back up a lot, especially with Wilbur Ross last week. And it gets into a lot of neat concepts and also mentions some labor issues, like with the Haymarket riots, National Steel, and A.E. Staley. So I hope you guys enjoy this and give it a listen. I know Molly's probably already back there bebopping and doing little finger jazz dancing thing, and Kai's probably rolling his eyes at this. So, anyway,
no
thanks.
Probably there.
What you talking about, Viper?
Friend, either you are closing your eyes to a situation you do not wish to acknowledge, or you are not aware of the caliber of disaster indicated by the presence of capital in your community. Well, you got trouble, my friends.
Oh my God, this is
trouble right here in Rip City. Why should I enjoy the fruits of commodity exchange and bland obsolescence? I consider that the hours I spend as part-time temp are golden. So I came to realize that those who do not own the means of production are compelled to bring the labor to the market in exchange for the bare necessities at a rate lower than the rate at which the owners
God,
of the means
great.
Can exchange a product
oh,
from that labor and call
God.
It a profit. It's unpaid labor, my friend. The first big step on the road to the depths of degradation. Say first. Surplus labor value. Then a thing called NAFTA. And the next thing you know,
then a thing
so
called NAFTA. That's right, it's going away. Don't worry about it. All right, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to put a link to that whole song at makemesmart.org. It is, of course, a riff on Trouble Right Here in River City, of course, from Music Man. 76 trombones, that whole deal. Wow.
Dude.
Wow.
Wow.
That was great.
You just made me smart. That was amazing.
So we ended with Music Man. We started with
Das
Hamilton.
Kapital.
Yes.
We did. See?
We
told you it was going to be a musical episode.
That's all we're doing is closing loops on this thing today. Closing loops.
Please subscribe. That's all we do. There's only a few themes in life, y'all. Only a few. Subscribe and review us on Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends about the show if you like it. And please remember, if you have an Amazon Echo and you want to be an early tester of our cool special project, email us testing@marketplace.org.
But it's a secret. We can't tell you what it is, or we'll get in trouble. Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. Senior producer is Eve Tro. This week's program was engineered by Drew Jostad and Charlton Thorpe. I guess it takes two to handle us. I don't know. Theme music is composed by Ben Talladay, was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves. It takes both of these women to handle us. And the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
It's a secret, but you need an echo. It's a secret.
It's a secret, despite the large hint. It's a large hint.